comes in, the goal is really just to stabilize. Some are coming from the streets and some are coming from jail. And some are just finishing a detoxing process. So once they've stabilized, they can then engage in the program, and they're going to classes, attending groups, seeing a counselor, going to self-help meetings at night, doing recreation. And they're in that intensive phase of treatment for about 14 weeks. And during that time, they're working with a case manager so that they can look at things like housing and employment. They're also building a clean and sober support network. So being in treatment for them is really more than just about understanding how to stay clean and sober, but it's really about rebuilding their lives.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 6 o'clock. Coming up next, Rose City Native Radio.
This song could go on without any end, till you realize that your car is not your friend. We're all car addicts, let's just say no, then those cars will have to go.
Help support KBOO Community Radio by donating your used car, truck, motorcycle, boat, or any other vehicle. We'll transform that old machine into resources for unserved and underserved communities, free training, recording equipment, and great programming for the Portland metro area, Cascadia, and the world. For more information, call 1-877-526-6123. That's 877-KBOO-123. Or go to kboo.fm/vehicle.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from U.S. Agencies Credit Union, providing local banking resources since 1936 and proudly serving Native Americans and their families. Details at usacu.org.
Federal health officials.
You're listening to Rose City Native Radio. I'm your host, Jackie Malmstrom. I wanted to announce this event happening this weekend at the beginning of the show because it's something that I know that affects a lot of people in Indian Country, as well as myself. I myself am a type 2 diabetic. I was diagnosed when I was 22, and so far I've managed to control it with diet and exercise. But I know that you know, there are a lot of people like me out there, as well as type 1 diabetics. So it's very important to learn skills on how to manage this, and together we can beat diabetes. So this Saturday, November 22nd, the American Diabetes Association is having an expo at the Oregon Convention Center. That's at 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. This is a free event. They will be offering free health screenings, cooking demonstrations, and talks on diabetes management, behavior change, and diabetes prevention. So this is a very important thing. If you or someone you know has diabetes and you're looking for help, this is going to be a great event for you. I myself am probably going to be going. So again, that's this Saturday, November 22nd, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. This is a free event for health screenings, cooking demonstrations, and talks on diabetes management, behavior, and prevention. The Oregon Convention Center is at 777 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. So definitely check that out. And on that topic, we will be playing a song from Restore Pride, which is a rap album about diabetes and diabetes prevention. This is No Time by Chief Rock.
Federal health officials say 24 million Americans, or 8% of the U.S. population, now has diabetes. 57 million more have pre-diabetes. NJN News health and medical correspondent Sarah Lee Kessler.
A new diabetes study undermines current thinking, which is that sharply lowering blood sugar reduces the risk of dying from heart
disease.
Juvenile
or type 1 diabetes is a disease that strikes children suddenly, making them insulin dependent for life, and there is no cure. But as NJN News health and medical correspondent Sarah Lee Kessler reports, new technology is making it easier, and there is no cure.
It's just straight pulling up through the drive-thru so I can get my caffeine. So I can feel alive, the only way I could survive working this 9-to-5. Need to make it through the day. A big cup to wake up for this Tuesday. And loads of overtime at the same damn line till break. Then it's off to the lunchroom with the loony for some snacks to take. Take back to the floor, ain't got no time anymore to make myself a proper meal. This crappy state I feel, my stomach, it's like it's made of steel with the junk that I eat. I always feel beat like I wanna go to sleep. And pissing every minute even if I don't drink too much. Feels like my body's out of touch.
And I don't feel like me. Don't know what this could be. Something's eating me inside. Feels like my body's on a roller coaster ride.
I sleep, it can never be enough. I had enough of this thirsty state and those damn mood swings. The stress that it brings, it's really affecting my work. I'm like a zombie at work, wanna get through the week. I'm getting a lot older, no longer at my peak. And maybe that's why my body's so weak. Finding ways to ignore piling bottles on the floor. My girl's stressing me out, I'm living in doubt with this constant mental block. I guess it's time to see the doc. I'm losing my breath every time that I walk. This is driving me berserk. Got back my blood work. The doc sat me down, said he had some bad news. Told me I was diabetic. I lost my mind, I tried to forget it. Reject it.
And I don't feel like me. Don't know what this could be. Something's eating me inside. Feels like my body's on a roller coaster ride.
Been a few months living with this disease that brought my health to its knees by the poor choices in food that I love to eat, the drinks that taste sweet, the processed meats. Diabetes will never beat my spirit and my will to live. And all this crap food is what I must give up in order to get my health back on track. My wife's got a baby on the way, so there's no way I can start stepping back. I'm only type 2 when the living foods will help push me through this nightmare I'm living through. And I can be living proof, raise off this truth about this disease. And raise off my knees to heal myself, heal my mind and my spirit as one. They tell me it never can be done, to my head they hold a gun. Gonna stand my ground, never gonna run or be overrun by the TV singing to me. Healthy living every day is gonna be my key to set me free. Healthy living every day is gonna be the key to set me free.
And I don't feel like me. Don't know what this could be. Something's eating me inside. Feels like my body's on a roller coaster ride.
That was No Time by Chief Rock. Coming up next, No Dogs or Indians by Tony Garcia here on KBOO Portland.
Kapila, inishiwashite. Tungashila, omaki ayo. Mitakuye, oyasen. All my relations. Pilamia.
Ask me who killed Custer. I said he killed himself. He took an oath, he made a promise, took the blame in somebody else. Major Reno, he told. You know, he said, I really didn't like him well, 'cause he wouldn't wait. So he met his fate. And they said, no dogs or Indians are allowed in here. No dogs or Indians gonna be allowed. We got the message. It was very clear. No dogs or Indians gonna be allowed in here. No dogs or Indians gonna be allowed. I know you heard about that Captain Jack. A Modoc Indian killed a general, shot him in his tracks. Everybody on the rest said, now we can't go home. And all that's left is our dying song. Down to the bar, went to celebrate. Drinking whiskey and champagne. I see your back, boy, and it's much too late. You better leave, you better get out right away. 'Cause no dogs or Indians are allowed in here. No dogs or Indians gonna be allowed. Fret. They say we never think that way. We could have gotten even, but we haven't yet. 'Cause all we really want to do is pray. Our culture's strong and our spirit's bright. We teach our children to pray for us every night. Caught in the middle of these crazy ways. All we wanted to do was pray. Oh yeah. All we wanted to do was pray. Yeah, yeah, done, all that damage done by the 7th Cavalry. It was wrong, it was vengeance, it was wrong, wrong, wrong. No dogs or Indians are allowed in here. No dogs or Indians gonna be allowed, that's clear. We got the message, yeah, yeah. It was very clear now. No dogs or Indians gonna be allowed.
That was No Dogs or Indians Allowed by Tony F. Garcia, a local artist. Coming up here is our interview with Paul Lumley, the executive director from the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. Enjoy. So much for joining us today. To start off, can you tell us a little bit about what you do?
Sure. Well, I'm the executive director for the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission, and I started working for the Fish Commission back in 1987, which is quite a long time ago, and started out as a summer intern sampling fish out at Bonneville Dam, and my job changed several times over the years. Went back to D.C. for 5 years, did some different things, and now I'm back since 2009 as the executive director.
Wow, so you have quite a history with salmon and fish in general, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Even before that, I was a tribal fisherman, fishing with my family, and there's a long line of tribal fishers in my family, so it goes back centuries.
That's really cool. And you're from here?
I'm not from Portland, but I'm from the Northwest. Mm-hmm. I'm a citizen of the Yakima Nation, and I was born and raised on the reservation and fished along the Columbia ever since I was a little baby.
Wow. Oh, wow. And so what does the Fish Commission do? How do they work?
Well, we have four tribes, Yakima, Umatilla, Warm Springs, and Nez Perce, and they all came together in 1977 and formed the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission with three primary objectives. The first is to bring back the fish runs. The second is to protect the treaty Indian fishing right. And the third is to establish a coordinated intertribal enforcement program.
So there's a lot of things that have been threatening the salmon, and also tribal fishing rights, especially recently, like with the Moro Pacific coal terminal that was proposed and protested. And I understand that you guys were also protesting with the tribes as well when that was going on.
Well, the Yakima Nation did have a protest out there, and mm-hmm. we support the Yakima Nation's efforts, as well as all four tribes in their opposition to the increased train traffic for not just the coal, but also the oil coming through. Both are very dangerous.
Yes.
In fact, I was on the Columbia River not too long ago, just in September, late September, and at a place called Columbia Hills Park, and right next to the train tracks, there's coal everywhere. It blows off the top of the trains, right into the water. People think that the coal doesn't come off the trains, but it does. It does a lot.
And what kind of damage can this do to the environment, the salmon's environment?
Well, coal is a contaminant. And once it gets into the Columbia, especially the Columbia River, that is, when it gets into the Columbia and enters into an area where there's no oxygen, it dissolves and turns into methyl mercury, which gets into the fish and causes problems not only with the fish, but the people who eat the fish. Also, and when the coal gets burned, it does the same thing. A lot of this coal is being shipped over to China, and where they will burn it, and then it blows back onto us as pollution and the rainwater and gets into our watersheds.
And also some of these coal terminals as well as oil are near tribal lands as well. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. We have a really vibrant tribal community along the Columbia. They're still there. There was a policy of the government to take the Indians off the river and put them on reservations, but a lot of them didn't leave. They're still there, and they live along the river. There's actual fishing sites that were set aside by the federal government still, and there's communities there. Very beautiful area, the Columbia River Gorge, just incredibly, incredibly unique. Big cliffs and a river that goes right in the middle of the Cascades. And so if you're going to live and fish there, you're pretty much going to be sandwiched between a cliff and the river, and there's a freeway there and a railroad track. And so all these proposals to bring back more coal and oil cause problems because our communities are right next to those train tracks, and that's where we fish. So if there's coal blowing off of these train tracks that's going into our lungs and where we live, if there's an accident, especially with the oil, it could be very, very dangerous. And there's so many oil trains coming back now, much more than we ever expected. So it's not really a matter of if there's going to be an accident. It's really a matter of when and how big it's going to be. So we saw what happened in Ontario, Canada, when that train broke loose and blew up in a downtown area and killed a lot of people. That could very well happen along the Columbia River or in another town nearby in the Columbia River. And if that coal, or excuse me, if that oil gets into the Columbia River, it's different than the kind of oil you see on TV, say down in the Gulf of Mexico, where they can sort of skim off the top. This oil is different. It's very thick and gooey, and it will sink to the bottom of the Columbia and will create an environmental disaster that will last decades, maybe centuries, may never be the same.
And there's lots of villages there that, you know, rely on that river as well for food and for survival, basically. And it also goes right through the heart of Portland. That's a very big risk that we're taking.
You know, one thing that really concerns me about the potential for disasters like this is who's gonna try and fix it once the accident happens? And the railroads talk about how they have this mitigation plan, but and I appreciate that they have some level of responsibility. But if you look at what they really will do, their responsibility only is to get the train track running again so they can have commerce flowing. They will have no responsibility for what's in those cars. They only own the engine and the caboose. What's in between the engine and the caboose is another responsible party. So they will get the train tracks running again, but the community that's affected, that'll have to be this company that put that material in those rail cars. And then we see what happened, and I think there was a major water contamination issue in, I think it was West Virginia. Mm-hmm. That's where they were making this sticky, gooey substance that goes on top of the coal, and that got loose. And after that happened, the very next day, that company filed for bankruptcy. And so the local community is really on the hook for the cleanup. And that could very well happen along the Columbia. If who is the responsible party, and are they really going to help if there's a major disaster? We don't know the answers to that. We'd like to think that there's an insurance company somewhere that would make sure that there's some liability there.
Yeah.
But even the insurance company, insurance companies won't give us straight answers or even be there. They can't guarantee that they would be there. If there was a major disaster, they might go bankrupt too. So there really are no assurances at all who is going to help fix the problem if there's a major disaster. Mm-hmm. That's a problem.
Yeah, definitely. And, something that could potentially destroy, a lot of lives and has before, and then they get footed with the bill in the end and passing on the responsibility.
And we saw all these fish coming back this year. It's truly amazing. And what if we had a train disaster in the middle of all this? All those fish would die. That'd be a big step in the wrong direction. Although I do have to say, it's pretty neat to see all these fish coming back.
Yes, and on that topic too, it's record numbers this year. Is that right?
Correct. And last year too.
And last year. Mm-hmm. Wow. So what do you think was a factor in that, in helping get more salmon back both this year and last year? Because I know that there have been, other methods used, like the salmon cannon and things, but what do you think really helped bring them back?
Well, it really is wonderful to see all the fish coming back. We had over 2 million fish, which is wonderful.
Wow.
Some years we don't get anywhere near that.
Yeah.
I remember when I was working for the Fish Commission in the 90s, we had just a fraction of that. So it is amazing to see the kind of turnaround that we have. When the four tribes that I worked for, when they signed treaties with the federal government back in 1855, we had somewhere between 17 million as high as 35 million fish coming back.
Wow.
So the Columbia River used to support a lot more fish than even the 2 million that we have now. So while it's great to see all these fish coming back, we have a long way to go before we achieve the kind of condition that the tribes experienced when they signed the treaties in 1855, when they reserved their right to fish. They reserved that right. It's not something that was granted to them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that they retained. They never gave it up. So we, as tribes, want to see the same kind of runs that we saw in the 1855 time frame. So mm-hmm. we do have a long ways to go, but over 2 million is wonderful.
Yeah.
We saw over 600,000 sockeye come back. Those went up to Okanagan region in Canada. The First Nation up there who did great work in restoring habitat and using hatcheries as a tool. Mm-hmm. We had huge returns of fall chinook last year and this year, over 1 million fall chinook alone. So, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And they're reaching areas that we never thought could be possible. The Snake River area, the last major dam for them, for those fall chinook, is Lower Granite. And we had over 60,000 fall chinook go up there. And most of those were wild fish, which is pretty amazing. Wow. Because back in the 1990s, after the ESA listing, the state and federal governments wanted to shut our fishery down because they said that these fish are now, there's some endangered fish in there. Mm-hmm. And we said, oh no, there's a much bigger response the federal government must make to protect our fishing right before you can ask us to quit fishing. You mm-hmm. have dams out there, you have habitat destruction, you've got a hatchery program that's run amok, not helping, actually making things worse. And we ended up having a settlement, and out of that settlement we got a fall chinook program up there that was reformed completely to try and bring the fish back. So instead of just producing fish for a sport or a commercial fishery, mm-hmm. non-Indian yeah. benefit, we got it switched around to use the same kind of fish that are out in the habitat. And when you bring them into the hatchery, rear them, take advantage of that life history and great survival advantage there, release them back out there where you took them from. Mm-hmm. Get a lot more that way. And then when they come back, you let them spawn. So we've been doing that since the mid-90s. And we went from less than 1,000 now to over 60,000. And so we're showing that you can use hatcheries as a way to rebuild naturally spawning fish. You might think of them not just as hatcheries, but actually as wild fish nurseries. So it really is amazing what you can do if we put our minds together.
Yeah.
And really work together. And it was a difficult time in the 90s going to court. I was an expert witness in that court case.
Oh, wow.
So it was pretty hard. But now to see the kind of partnership develop, mm-hmm. we look past that now. We have a great partnership with the federal agencies in the state of Washington, Idaho, and Oregon. And the tribe that's in lead is Nez Perce Tribe in this project. So it's really wonderful to see everybody in partnership now. And we had a tough time, but boy, but the future is so bright.
Do most tribal hatcheries work like that then, and with that platform?
I'd like to say that we have a lot of them.
Yeah.
We don't. We only have a few. And we've had a great struggle over the many decades that we've proposed hatchery reform. The tribes actually started proposing this back in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. But a lot of these hatcheries were designed to benefit non-Indian sport and commercial fisheries. Oh. And so when you try to take existing hatchery programs and their funding and try to reform it to benefit naturally spawning fish, maybe even in areas where the tribes could benefit from it, mm-hmm. There's a little bit of a resource struggle there because there is a very limited amount of hatchery space, a very limited amount of federal funding. And so we've had our struggles over the years trying to get the state and federal fishery agencies interested in using these hatchery programs as this amazing tool for recovery. It can be done.
Yeah.
You can change these hatcheries into wild fish nurseries.
And you guys have proven that already.
We have, yes. The problem that we have is that the non-Indian sport fisheries and commercial fisheries, they don't have a treaty right like we do. And so even though Endangered Species Act came along, the tribes can still fish because mm-hmm. we have that treaty right. Mm-hmm. But the non-Indian fisheries, they can't take the wild fish. They need to say that they're going after the hatchery fish, which are not listed. And so they've marked them. They cut off one of the fins. It's called marking. They mark all of the hatchery fish, sort of like branding cattle. And when they do that, they say, well, these are our fish now, and we're going to take these fish, and these are the ones we're going to take, not the wild fish. So they catch the hatchery fish and keep them, mm-hmm. and the wild fish don't have a clipped fin. Mm-hmm. They have to throw those back. And so it creates an incentive for them to keep the hatchery programs the way they are and not move towards these wild fish nurseries that the tribes want to do. So it is a very difficult process for us to try and get the state and federal agencies to change their ways. Mm-hmm. But slowly they are, and especially for places like the Snake River Basin where all these fall chinook are coming back,
yeah.
We've shown that not only can you have this amazing recovery program going on, but you can have pretty good abundance enough to support significant fisheries.
Yeah, definitely.
Both tribal and non-tribal. Mm-hmm. And so we've got now the sport fishermen are saying, well, wait a minute here. Why do we have to throw the wild fish back? That doesn't make sense. There's a whole bunch of wild fish out there. Mm-hmm. So they're starting to see the discrimination even on them. And they want to see the tribal programs succeed. And they're saying, well, maybe the tribes are onto something here. Abundance is the key.
Yeah.
And so if we can get the fishing communities, the general public interested in using hatchery reform, we can see a lot more success. So we saw great success there. The coho programs are doing great. We had 18,000 coho go past Lower Granite Dam this year, which is up from zero a couple decades ago.
Oh, wow.
It was zero for several decades.
Jeez.
So that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And so everyone's really happy about that. We had great coho returns in the Umatilla and the Yakima and the Klickitat. So sockeye programs are getting restored in the Yakima as well. We just really, really going gangbusters here and using hatcheries as a tool for recovery.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just hatcheries, though, that are bringing all the fish back. We have pretty good ocean conditions, which is also happening. But if you look where these wild fish nurseries are not, yeah, it's increased, but it hasn't increased near as much as where we've had the benefit of the tribal hatchery program reform doing
mm-hmm.
it. We have this also a huge recovery program. It's the biggest in the nation, maybe the biggest in the world.
Really?
Yeah. Well, the Columbia River used to produce more salmon than any other place in the world. Now it produces more electricity.
Ah.
And so we have what's called the Northwest Power Act that put together a fish and wildlife recovery program.
Mm-hmm.
And so everyone who pays their energy bills, a small amount of that goes to that fund. And so you pay your energy bill, I pay my energy bill, mm-hmm. some of that goes into this fund and it goes out to mitigating for the effects of the hydropower system. And so it's now the largest single species recovery program anywhere else in the world. It's pretty amazing, and it's right here in our backyard.
Yeah.
And we're seeing all these fish come back, and we can all walk down the street and pat each other on the back and say, job well done.
Yeah, did you pay your power bill? Well, you just helped save the salmon too.
You did. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a great idea too. Mm-hmm.
You know, we have all this progress, and it's really good, but we also have some pretty big challenges out there.
Yes.
And I just came from a meeting that we hosted in our office here in Portland, and it was with 15 tribal nations mm-hmm. in the Columbia River Basin and the Environmental Protection Agency, and we haven't sat down with them like that. Well, maybe not ever. It's the first time, and looking at the whole Columbia River Basin as one single watershed and working with EPA in partnership, what can we do together to improve the water quality? So, you know, it's interesting. You look at those old pictures at Salila Falls, and you see them sitting on the platform, and you also see a bucket there that's on a rope.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they would drink the water. They would lower the bucket into the Columbia River, bring it up, and they drink out of the bucket. So that was not too long ago. That's people's memory still. And would you drink out of the Columbia right now?
No.
Well, I wouldn't either.
No, I wouldn't even swim in it.
Well, it's probably safe to swim in, but I wouldn't drink the water.
No.
And so we have a long way to go to clean up the Columbia River. And you know, you and I can choose right now. We can choose. Do you want to drink any of that water? I say no. But the fish, they got no choice in that at all. They got to drink that water. And so they get contamination in them. And some of that contamination is pretty bad. Tribes eat a lot of fish. And we did a study back in the early 1990s, and we found out that our tribal members were eating 10 times more fish than the general public. And then we looked at the contaminants that were actually in the fish, and there's some pretty nasty contaminants. And then if you take those two things together, we're not doing all we can to protect the tribal community from eating contaminated fish. And so what are you going to do about it?
Yeah.
And you have to start looking at the states and their water quality standards.
Mm-hmm.
And something happened that was pretty amazing about 5 years ago. And the state of Oregon changed their water quality standards to be more in concert with how much fish the tribes were eating. And so now we have by at least 10 times the most protective water quality standard in the nation. Way out in the forefront here.
Yeah.
Amazing work. It was really hard to do too. It, you know, after completing that study in the 1990s and then, you know, just not too long ago, it took almost, you know, 2 decades to get Oregon to come around, but they did. They did the right thing. Oregon got it right. But, you know, just across the Columbia River is the state of Washington, and they're having struggles, and they have to do the same thing. They have to update their water quality standards, and they're having great difficulty. And then we have going upriver, you have the state of Idaho. You know, these are all in the Columbia River Basin. The state of Idaho has to update their water quality standards, and we got big challenges with Idaho, probably bigger challenges in Idaho. So is our work cut out for us on water quality? You bet. But if we approach this, you know, with this partnership and this togetherness, we can accomplish great things. We showed we can do that with the fish runs.
Yes.
So let's do something with the water quality. Let's clean up the Columbia River mm-hmm. so it's clean enough to drink out of.
And you're listening to KBOO Portland, Rose City Native Radio. If you're just tuning in with us, we are talking with Paul Lumley from the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission.
That's you know really what amazing. We also often forget about is that there's a lot of water that comes in from Canada too. And so I remember when I first started working for the Fish Commission, I was looking at these maps on the walls, and we didn't even show the whole watershed. We cut it off at Canada. And it's a lot of water up there.
There is a lot.
Then not too long ago, I was up visiting with the First Nations up there, and I looked at their maps, and their maps cut it off at the United States. You know, the Columbia River Basin goes into Montana, too, and people forget about that.
Really?
Yeah. On this side of the Rockies, all the water in Montana that goes into the Columbia River Basin eventually goes into Canada before it comes back into the United States.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's quite the journey.
Yeah. They have a dam out there that was built to protect the Canadians from flooding. Yeah. It was all part of this big agreement with Canada. It was called the Columbia River Water Treaty. Mm-hmm. It was completed in 1960s. And it actually built huge dams in Canada, too, and then one in Montana. And those dams in Canada have huge reservoirs, much bigger than out here. Mm-hmm. And it's all really to keep Portland from flooding. And what it did was it destroyed a lot of villages up there, a lot of towns, just to keep Portland dry. And so when you go up there and talk to the Canadians, whether they're First Nations or just people on the street, they remember that treaty like it was yesterday. They remember those towns that were destroyed, those churches that were burned, all to keep Portland dry. They're very bitter about it. Mm-hmm. So this treaty is up for renewal. It's being discussed very actively right now, and everyone wants to see a change up there, the people in the basin. And it's interesting that out here in Portland, you talk about the Columbia River Treaty. If I walk down the street, I probably have a hard time finding somebody that knew about the Columbia River Treaty. You've heard of the Vanport flood, haven't you?
Yes.
I was listening to a radio program maybe a year ago about people who experienced it. This is in the 1940s. And, that was a really interesting time frame for Portland. If you look at the history, there was a guy that wanted to build a shipyard, and he wanted to do it in downtown Portland. And the city of Portland said, no, we don't want that kind of a city, and we don't want people like that living in downtown, you know, working force people, immigrants, that kind of stuff. And so he ended up building his shipbuilding operation downriver in what's now the area of Janssen Beach, the Expo Center in that area.
Yeah, yeah.
And but he built a whole city out there along with it and put people there because people had a place to live. Well, there was really no protection for a big flood out there. There was a railroad tracks that sort of provided some protection, but it wasn't a levee of any kind. And this flood came, and a lot of people died. And it was a big flood. Don't get me wrong, it was a big flood, but people died, and they shouldn't have died. They shouldn't have built in the floodplain to begin with. But what happened was it spurred both countries to rush into an agreement real quick. And so they were talking about a treaty before that flood. And it was supposed to include the ecosystem, irrigation, fish, wildlife, all that was supposed to be included. But after that flood, they said, we're not going to talk about that anymore. We just want to talk about hydropower and flood control. All those other things about the ecosystem we can deal with later. And so it was unfortunate. If you look at what happened in the 1960s, that was a long time ago, before we had all these laws that we have now. Mm-hmm. We have the Endangered Species Act. We have Clean Water Act.
Yeah.
We now have a federal government that truly respects their trust responsibility to tribal nations. So that was then, and this is now.
Yes.
So the tribes all came together, all 15 tribes in the Columbia River Basin, and they forced this issue in a review process and made sure that the ecosystem is a part of the recommendation to the federal government, which is truly amazing. So what we're going to try and do is two big things, actually three, but two big ones. One is to restore fish runs back into Canada to get them over Grand Coulee. Now, that's long overdue. There's a dam just below it that was built after Grand Coulee Dam. It was called Chief Joseph. So there's another dam. It's a smaller dam. We had to get fish past both of those. We also want to look at flood control measures because we need to restore the river to a more free-flowing river like it was historically. Remember all those dams I was telling you about in Canada? What they did was they took that peak of the runout and went after the snow melt, so it doesn't flow the way it used to anymore because they're trying to keep Portland from flooding. So they hold all that water back. Well, that's when the fish need to be in the river, when all that water's moving through. So you can get all the smolts through the system quicker out to the ocean. But when they pull it back like that with all these dams, they pull all the water back and release it at a different time of the year, the fish leave the system later and it has a big impact on the salmon. It also causes great problems for the tribal communities above that area, above Grand Coulee, especially. So that reservoir goes up and down. That's right in their backyard. And so if you're doing this for fish flows, they get pretty frustrated, so we had to work together with them. There's also tribes and First Nations up there that lost all access to the fish. It's really sad.
Really?
Yeah, Spokane Tribe, Coeur d'Alene, all those First Nations. And we're down here celebrating all the fish coming back and they're still left on the bank with no fish. So we got to do something about it.
Yeah, definitely.
And looking at flood risk is one of them. And then just getting the third is getting all the fish flows restored as much as you can to improve survival. So, you know, on that flood risk thing, it's really interesting. People shouldn't build in the floodplain.
No, they shouldn't. That's probably not a good idea.
Let me ask you a question. Mm-hmm. So when you hear flood, mm-hmm. what's the first thing that comes to your mind?
Flood? Kind of almost like a catastrophic tidal wave, just kind of mm-hmm. splashing over all these houses and pushing stuff away and just mm-hmm. chaos.
Yeah.
Really.
When we think of flood, flood is a good thing. It's good for the fish. Mm-hmm. It's good for estuary health. It's mm-hmm. good for river health in general.
Yeah.
It's a very natural occurrence. But people were allowed to build in the floodplain. And so when you hear floods now, you think, oh, this is awful. Homes are going to be washed away. People might die. So we got to get people to rethink this whole paradigm. What is a flood? And it's actually a very good thing. Mm-hmm. It's bad when people build in the floodplain.
Yeah.
And so all these dams were built, and it gave people a false sense of security. I can live in the floodplain now. There's fertile land there. I can farm. And so if we're going to allow a little bit more flood risk for the fish flows, then we have to address some of that.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe people shouldn't be living in the floodplain.
Yeah, and think about why is that land fertile in the first place? Maybe because it gets flooded.
That's exactly it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But there are some places that you shouldn't build. That's just how it is.
A floodplain is one of them.
And a floodplain is definitely one of them.
You know, when I was... where was I? I was working with, I think it was in the Columbia River Treaty process.
Uh-huh.
We got a presentation comparing the Columbia River and Colorado River. And in the Colorado River, it's big dams, big reservoirs, and they can hold back more water than the river can produce.
Really?
So they can make sure, like 100%, there won't be a flood.
Wow.
In the Columbia River, it's about 25% maybe, something like that, a lot less. A lot less.
Oof.
So the chances of a flood happening are pretty high.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we tell people we can manage these floods with all these dams in place and there won't be a problem, but it will happen.
Yeah.
It's inevitable that there will be a flood. And so people shouldn't have been allowed to move in the floodplain without that kind of protection. And so you give people this permission to move into the floodplain, and what they do is they build homes, they build businesses there. And think of what's in your home. Think of what's in the business.
Mm-hmm.
There's some pretty nasty stuff, right?
Yeah.
Got some contaminants in there, maybe
oil,
whatever you use to build your home, whatever's in your home, whatever's
cleaning
in your kitchen.
Cleaning products, everything. All kinds of things, yeah.
So if we know it's going to flood eventually, then you know that everything you put in that floodplain will become contamination. So people never think about that. So when you let people build in the floodplain, you're giving them permission to pollute because eventually it'll be pretty nasty.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I was watching TV after Katrina and the Superstorm Sandy.
Yeah.
And people were saying that the contamination was incredible. The smell of sewage, the smell of oil, smell of contaminants was so bad people could hardly breathe. And so that's the same kind of thing you would see in the Columbia if there was a flood, a big flood that happened, you know, like a long time ago. It could still happen today.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're giving people permission to put that in the river, to put that in the ocean. So we probably need to start working with those who insure people,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So if FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Agency, they give flood insurance, right?
I think so,
They do, yeah. They give a lot of flood insurance. They give people, so you can build in the floodplain, but you have to have insurance. So we're going to give you this insurance. They are not including the liability of the contamination that would be released if there was a flood. It's not even in the insurance policy. So there's nobody liable for that kind of contamination. So we have to work with our federal agencies, all of them. And if we're going to look at a new way of managing the Columbia River, we have to look at all things, and that includes FEMA and insurance.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, there was a lawsuit in Washington State about this, and I think it was NOAA that said, our National Marine Fisheries Service, they do the biological opinions on the fish, and they ruled that FEMA didn't take into consideration what it means to the salmon, to the fish, if you build in the floodplain, if you give them the insurance to build in the floodplain.
Yeah.
And there was a lawsuit and FEMA lost. And so now the same lawsuit's in Oregon. I can't remember the status of that right now, but it's not good for FEMA. And I'm really glad to see that the National Marine Fisheries Service stood up for the fish, and I appreciate their efforts there on that because it's true.
Yeah.
You shouldn't let people to build in the floodplain without taking into consideration the impacts of the fish.
And like you said earlier, you know, who's going to be the one to clean this up once it happens?
Right.
And you're listening to KBOO Portland, Rose City Native Radio. If you're just tuning in with us, we are talking with Paul Lumley from the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission.
Hey, I'm going to change subjects on you.
Sure.
You brought up the fish cannon.
I did. Yeah. The salmon cannon, yes.
I thought that was so interesting. You know, I first started learning about them earlier this year. Mm-hmm. The Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission put on a conference. Mm-hmm. It's called Future of Our Salmon. And it is a focus on restoring fish runs to all historic locations. Mm-hmm. And once we announced the conference, all 15 tribes in the basin and the First Nations in Canada said, oh, we love it. We want to be a part of it. We want to co-host with you. And so they did.
Really?
Yeah. And we didn't want this to be a conference where you can come and have a conference and go home. We wanted to really make this worthwhile. So we had a technical workshop a month before the conference. So our technical workshop was in March. Mm-hmm. And then we had our main conference in April. Mm-hmm. And at the technical conference in March, that's when we learned about this this company that makes the salmon cannon. It's called Whoosh.
We have Whoosh. That's what it was.
And it's pretty neat. I don't know if we can use it to get fish over dams, but that's the thinking. So I asked him. I said, well, can we do this for Grand Coulee? That's a pretty big dam.
Yeah, yeah.
And he shook his head and he said, not with one. I might need two or maybe three. So I said, well, where can I sign? Get my checkbook out.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Oh, and there's other methods too, though. There was one that's like, I can't remember. It looks like a wheel, kind of like a Ferris wheel thing. And they pick up the salmon and put it over something like that. There's other methods as well that aren't as cool as the salmon cannon, though.
Right. Fish ladders.
Yeah, fish ladders. That's mm-hmm. it. That's it. My brain. Yeah, the fish ladders, but the salmon cannon, man, that's, now we're living in the future.
Yeah. Yeah, I just saw it on TV. Was it Stephen Colbert?
Yeah, John Oliver. That's, yeah.
Yeah,
that's...
yeah, I just saw it on TV, and it was pretty neat because those folks were at my conference earlier this year.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And the name of the company being Whoosh, that's perfect.
You know, back on that conference, when we first started talking about restoring fish at Grand Coulee, people thought we were crazy.
Really?
Yeah. It's like, that dam is huge. That reservoir is huge. That's never going to happen.
Yeah.
And we're not going to take no for an answer. If you can put a man on the moon, there has got to be a way to get fish restored back into Canada. There are too many tribes and First Nations on the other side of Grand Coulee Dam that have been without fish for too long.
Mm-hmm.
So we got to do something about that.
Yeah.
And so we went in with full confidence, and we brought people in from all over the country, all over the Columbia River Basin, outside the Pacific Northwest, mm-hmm. and brought in experts in that technical workshop. And one of the things that we learned was it is technically feasible to get fish runs restored at all these dams.
Really?
Yeah. It's just a matter of when and who's going to pay for it. But it's technically possible. And before that, it was like, you know, if we can get fish passage.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now we know we can do it. Mm-hmm. So we went to the conference, and it changed it entirely. It was no longer that if, it's a matter of when.
Mm-hmm.
And so the conference changed entirely and brought a lot of people together, putting ideas on paper. You know, how are we going to make this actually happen?
Mm-hmm.
And so then the 15 tribes and the First Nations put together their own study, and it's actually a phased approach to get fish runs restored into Canada, and I'm very excited about it. It is going to happen. It is going to happen in my lifetime. I'm pretty excited about it. We just have to get people working together.
Yeah.
That's all. It's just, you know, when is it going to happen? What's the political willpower to make it happen?
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be as expensive as people think, not initially.
Really?
Now, maybe in the future, if you actually want to put fish ladders at Grand Coulee, that could be expensive. There are other ways of getting fish passage restored, and, mm-hmm. and we're going to explore all avenues to make sure it happens. So I'm pretty excited about it. When that conference was happening, I had goosebumps in my arms because I just know it's going to happen now.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. And you know, once you get all these great minds thinking together, it's amazing what you guys have come up with so far,
mm-hmm.
and what you guys have achieved so far. So, I mean, sky's the limit for you guys as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah.
It's a matter of saying you can do it and doing it. It's pretty neat to watch it happen. We're seeing changes I never thought I would see.
You know, and it seems like you guys are kind of also turning some feds onto your side as well and waking them up and being like, hey, guys, salmon is important, mm-hmm. in more ways than one. And, you know,
we're still friends with them. You know, yeah. I often tell them, especially the Corps of Engineers, just because I sue you doesn't mean I don't love you.
No hard feelings, guys.
Because we still have to work with them. You know,
yeah.
They're people too, and they have a job to do, and we have a job to do ourselves. So, you know, let's keep it real. Let's no need to be mean.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we do have a pretty evil history if you think about it, and we're trying to right some wrongs. And there were a lot of people that lost a lot over the years. And so we have a long ways to go, not even just beyond the fish.
Mm-hmm.
The tribes and the First Nations were treated pretty badly. And just to keep Portland dry, we have all these dams now to produce all this energy.
Mm-hmm.
It's not fair. And if you look at what's behind these dams, these big reservoirs, those are permanent floods. They're still there. And what a sacrifice to make, right? To keep Portland dry. Those floods are still there. Big floods. Biggest flood this continent has ever seen. Probably comparable only to biblical proportions.
Jeez.
And it's still there today. And we look past it. We don't even look at what it really means. Go past Bonneville Dam. There used to be villages there. And when the tribes are moved out, they didn't get any compensation, or not very much.
Yeah.
Yet there were whole towns that were moved, non-Indian towns. But at the time, it was a policy of the federal government to get rid of the Indians, to assimilate them in society.
Yeah, kill the Indian, save the man, mm-hmm. and other things.
Mm-hmm. So we're still actually working very hard right now as we speak to right that wrong on those villages that were destroyed,
mm-hmm.
those tribal homes that were not compensated.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there was a pretty interesting article that just came out in several news outlets across the country, including the Washington Post, about that obligation the federal government has to restore those villages and to repay the tribes and build those homes for them.
Mm-hmm.
So that is something we're also working on and trying to make sure that that those wrongs are eventually righted. You know, if you go out to Bonneville Dam on the Washington side and you go just downriver of Bonneville Dam,
mm-hmm.
there's a place called North Bonneville. That town was relocated in the 1980s when they built the second powerhouse of Bonneville Dam.
Mm-hmm.
In the 1980s. I'm really happy for them. You know, they have pretty nice setup down there. Great big roads. They have, you know, fire department, big gas station, city hall. Maybe 100 homes, schools, golf course.
Uh-huh.
It's a whole city.
Yeah.
A really nice city. A brand new city.
Oh, man.
Just down below Bonneville Dam. You go just above Bonneville Dam. There used to be a tribal village up there that was once called Fort Raines. And mm-hmm. You see people living next to the river. Shacks.
Yeah.
It's really sad. There's no water, no running water, no electricity. They're still waiting for their homes. So, you know, is it fair? Not by a long shot.
No.
And that wasn't the only community that was non-Indian community that was replaced. You know, many cities up there, Roosevelt, Arlington, Umatilla,
mm-hmm.
all these non-Indian cities that got relocated, tribes didn't get it. If you go up to the Dalles Dam, there's a just down below the Dalles Dam on the Oregon side, there's a community called Lone Pine.
Mm-hmm.
And you might think it's a junkyard, but people live there.
Wow.
It's surrounded by barbed wire fence. And there's people living in very, very primitive dwellings. No electricity, no running water. All they have is a bathroom there. It's a public bathroom. That's where they do their dishes. That's where they do their cooking. It's some of the worst housing conditions I have ever seen. Remember I told you I was in Washington, D.C.? I was the executive director of the National American Indian Housing Council.
Oh.
So I worked with tribes nationally, and so I know what bad housing looks like.
Yeah.
And I have never seen anything this bad. It is really sad. And it's right there, right under our own nose. We don't see it. It's very cruel. It's right next to the dam. You look up at the dam. They look at that dam every day. All that wealth that's created there, yet they don't even get free electricity. There was actually some relocation assistance. This is back in the 1950s. Oh. The dam was built in 1957.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some compensation offered to the tribes, and they gave them a pretty big chunk of land over there by the Dalles Dam, what was once to become the Dalles Dam. They didn't tell the tribes, here's your land, you can have that land, only to find out a few years later they'd be taken away because that's where a dam's going to go in. Government knew they were going to put a dam there. So those people ended up being scattered.
Yeah.
Some of them went to what is now known as Lone Pine.
Uh-huh.
So we have to do better with the tribal housing conditions on the along the Columbia River. We have to force the federal government through the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to do the right thing
mm-hmm.
for tribal housing. It is really, really a sad commentary to see this happening, even by today's standards.
Yeah.
This is something you might read about. Oh, yeah, this happened back in the 1800s. No, this is right now. This is 2014. It's here. So we want to see a better situation for those tribal members down on the river. They shouldn't have to live that way.
Mm-hmm. So for people who are interested in getting involved, how can someone help your cause?
Well, we do have a website. Mm-hmm. It's our acronym is CRITFC. Mm-hmm. It's .org. And there's a little button there if you want to donate funding. We do need funding to wherever we can to implement these salmon habitat restoration projects. Mm-hmm. You can write letters to Congress. That's very, very helpful, especially on the housing right now. We need people to say something.
Yeah.
All this coal and oil train transportation, big problems right now.
Yeah.
Write to your permitting agencies. Let them know how you feel. Mention the tribes as a vulnerable community along the Columbia River that's maybe forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot that can be done with just the basic salmon habitat restoration projects that we do for the Power Council's programs.
Mm-hmm.
Support the tribes. Send letters to the Power Council. Let them know you support the tribe's wild salmon nursery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hatchery reform.
Yeah.
That's a benefit that everyone gets. It's not just one fishing group, but everyone benefits from having fish spawning historically.
Yeah.
To all locations. So that would be wonderful too. And on the Columbia River Treaty, it'd be nice if the federal agencies and our congressional representatives understand that there needs to be a new way of managing this river, and people shouldn't be allowed to build on the floodplain the way they did. And it's time to right some wrongs there too, and restore this river to some of its historic flows.
Mm-hmm. Well, Paul, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I've learned a lot, and listeners, hopefully you have too. It was really great talking with you. Thank you for coming in.
You're welcome. I had a great time. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to thank everybody for tuning in today. I want to especially thank Paul Lumley for sitting down with us today. We have a few things on the community calendar coming up. This Saturday, November 22nd at PSU, Remembering Loved Ones, Stories of Loss and Grief. Join Healing Feathers student volunteers as we recognize the stories of trauma and grief of Native American survivors of suicide. This will be a time of sharing stories, empathetic listening, and support. Again, that is this Saturday, November 22nd at PSU, 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. Also, Saturday, November 22nd is the American Diabetes Association Expo, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. This is a free event for free health screenings, cooking demonstrations, and talks on diabetes management, behavior change, and prevention at the Oregon Convention Center. Next Monday, November 24th, from 3 to 5 p.m. at PSU is How the Grinch Stole Thanksgiving with Dr. Cornell Piwardi, a thought-provoking workshop on the Native American perspective of Thanksgiving. Again, that's next Monday, November 24th, 3 to 5 p.m. at PSU. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram for behind-the-scenes photos at Rose City Native Radio. If you have any events or know of anybody we should talk to on the show, feel free to email us at pdxnativeradio@gmail.com. Also, if you're interested in getting involved with KBOO, you can email volunteer@kboo.org. For more information on the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission, you can go online to CRITFC.org. I want to thank everybody for listening today. And remember, in this cold weather, be sure to check in on elders and people with small children. Look out for everybody out there, and stay warm, Indian Country. I'll see you next week on Thanksgiving.
Join KBOO at the Clinton Street Theater for our monthly movie screening night. This month, KBOO proudly presents Alice's Restaurant, the film based on a song based on Arlo Guthrie's 1965 Thanksgiving Day. Alice's Restaurant will screen Wednesday, November 26th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information about the film at KBOO at the Clinton series can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under the community events.
You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant.
Join KBOO the first Friday of each month at 9 a.m. for APA Compass. APA Compass is a monthly forum for dialogue, exploration, and dissemination of issues permitted to Asian Pacific American communities. That's the first Friday of the month at 9 a.m. on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
I'm Dime Roberts. In 1989, I took a trip to Taiwan with my mother and produced a radio documentary about our relationship. It's called Mei Mei, A Daughter's Song.